This morning, this is tape number 4, recorded on the morning of June the 1st, 1972, in the office of President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde in the Executive Building. Interview between President Emeritus Hovde and Professor R.B. Eccles.
How far along had we gotten in the last interview?
Back in the States in 1943 or 44, I believe, returning from London, and we're working in the office in Washington, D.C.
When I returned from London, in the summer of 1942, I came back to National Defense Research Committee headquarters at 1530 P Street in Washington, the Carnegie Institution building, with an assignment as Executive Assistant to Dr. James B. Conant, President of Harvard University. A short while before that, the National Defense Research Committee and the Committee on Medical Research were reorganized under the aegis of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. Conant headed the National Defense Research Committee, and if my memory serves me correctly, Dr. Richards of the University of Pennsylvania headed the Committee on Medical Research, while Van Bush, Menever Bush, became the director of the Office of Scientific Research and Development. At that time, in 1942, Dr. Conant also was heavily involved in the rubber problem, the need for rubber had to be met, and the supply of natural rubber was wholly inadequate and difficult to obtain.
And people could only be patriotic by giving so many bath mats.
And another problem at that time was the organization, and under great conditions of tremendous secrecy, the organization of the teams to develop the atomic bomb. Conant was heavily involved in both of these critical organization, research, and management problems. As his executive assistant, I was not concerned with either the atomic bomb problem or the rubber problem, but with the ongoing research and development program of the major divisions of the National Defense Research Committee, which had been in being almost from the beginning, and which were concerned primarily with weapons and instrumentalities of war. One of the the problems that was with the divisions and teams of National Defense Research Committee, all of which were civilian in nature. Most of the contract groups were managed by universities, some by industries, industrial corporations, had the problem of relationships with the military organization. And when military developments reached the stage where testing had to take place, the Army, Navy, and then the Air Corps at that time had to assign liaison officers, had to find bases and facilities for testing work, and many of the programs and so on were because they were civilian, developed by civilian groups and so on, found difficulty with the found difficulties put in their way by the military, who were of course naturally preoccupied with the existing machine and getting it ready to fight, and they couldn't be slowed up and delayed by the promise of something better to fight with later on. Although it turned out in the end that a large measure of the Allied victory, in my judgment at any rate, came about because the Allies were able to defeat the submarine and by the sea, and the airplane by the air, the German submarine at that stage of its development, and the German airplane and the by air, and the German tanks on the ground. Blitzkrieg, which Hitler had pinned his faith to. And then, of course, the development of amphibious warfare, primarily to serve in the Pacific, was the answer, of course, and helped in with the problem of the invasion of Normandy beaches. Development of landing craft of all types and kinds and special equipment was a necessity if successful landings were to be achieved. And the story of the landing operations in the Pacific, of course, is was one of essentially the use of all the techniques of amphibious warfare. One area of weapon development which proceeded during the summer of 42 was that of rocket weapons. And there were two schools of development, both of which were being developed by the National Defense Research Committee teams. One school was devoted to development of rocket artillery weapons based on the use of the wet powders, rocket powders, extruded single base rocket powders extruded in the wet form. These particular types of powders burned very rapidly because they could not be extruded in large sections, and rocket powder burns on the surface of the powder. The time of burning within the casing depends on the amount of surface that's burning and the pressure within the rocket casing. The other group at Caltech, well, the first group, the wet extruded powder group, was headed by Dr. Charles C.N. Hickman, who had been a young man interested in rocketry and had known and worked with the pioneer of American rocketry, Dr. Goddard. Hickman was a Bell Telephone Lab scientist at the time the war broke out and was assigned to this phase of the rocket program. The Caltech program was based on dry extruded powder, a technology that the English had used in the development of their rockets. The English, however, had worked for years with so-called double base powders and had the technology of extruding double base powders, whereas our Navy from the beginning had gone with single base powders and had not developed the British technology. So starting from scratch at Caltech, Lauritsen, Sage, Lacey, and others had built extrusion presses in a little canyon called Eaton Canyon near Pasadena, and successfully extruded double base powders for the types of rockets developed at Caltech. Well, the two groups were at odds with each other, and in the spring of 43.
Was it fighting over appropriations or fighting over methodology or just fighting?
Well, you had so much manpower and so many problems, and each group felt that their particular methodology would
take priority.
Should take priority. And Conant and Bush asked me to head the rocket division, and try to manage the division with its conflicting types of programs. Conflicting in one sense and not in another.
Did you also have a third element in there of military men?
Yes, we had military men. We had the group, the Eastern group, was located at Cumberland, Maryland. Had as one of their objectives the production of an aircraft rocket. But earlier than that, that group had been involved in the production of the bazooka. Now, the bazooka was conceived as a weapon which could destroy it, would be a weapon in the hands of a lone infantryman which could destroy a tank. It was one of the weapons that had been developed to counter the German tank. And the bazooka was one of the earliest rocket weapons that was adopted and put into combat. The rocket weapon, 3.5-inch aircraft rocket weapon and artillery rocket, meant collaboration with the Army Ordnance people. And the Eastern Group had great difficulties with the Army Ordnance people because over the years the Ordnance staff of the Army were wedded to their fine field guns. They wanted weapons that would hit a dime at 20 miles. The only problem with that is that you never knew where the dime was when it came to using artillery in the field. You never had accurate information as to where you wanted to hit, what objects you wanted to hit. And I suppose during the war, over 90% of the shells fired were fired as barrages, barrage fire. The Western Group, however, had a whole series of projects, weapons, which are of great interest to the Navy. The anti-submarine rockets called the mouse traps, the beach barrage rockets, and the 3 1/4-inch and the 5-inch aircraft rockets, the retro-firing bomb rockets for the slow-flying naval patrol craft, the anti-submarine weapon. Big tiny Tim rockets, 10-inch aircraft rockets, which gave the 5-inch aircraft rocket and the 10-inch aircraft rocket gave the aircraft a devastating punch, because you couldn't put artillery on airplanes. And the rocket became a high-velocity, more aimable bomb. Just drop free-falling bomb.
Did we contemplate any research such as the V-2s, the Germans?
Well, I'll get to that later.
All right.
All in all, the problem Caltech Group. The problem, as the Caltech Group saw it, was to get to produce rocket weapons where they would be effective and where there was no competition. The rocket weapons produced at Caltech did not compete with conventional artillery, 75 millimeter guns and up.
105s, 240s.
And they were designed for purposes which for which there were had no previous weapons were available. And with the manufacturing facilities of Eaton Canyon to produce powder, and with the facilities of the Naval Ordnance Test Station at Inyokern out in the desert to fire rockets, both in the field and from vehicles, facilities at Camp Pendleton for the on the Pacific coast for testing amphibious rockets. The Caltech Group went ahead and produced in quantities for even for military use in the field some 15 or 16 rocket weapons. The problem within the division, as I attempted to resolve it, was to get the Eastern Group working on those aspects of rocketry, which they had started, which had merit and were worth prosecuting, and to eliminate some of the duplication.
Was yours essentially then a management problem?
Oh, mine was a management problem for two large groups. When the 5-inch aircraft rocket was developed, we were making them in experimental quantities. You have to make a lot of rockets, you see, and fire them on the ranges to get reliability and to develop all the ways of transporting them and shipping them and storing them and handling them in the field and the auxiliary equipment that goes with the weapon and training troops to use them and so on. And all this had to be started the first moment that a new weapon showed any real promise.
You remember the Captain James Pritchard at Inyokern in Ordnance, Navy Ordnance?
I don't remember that particular name. But the need for this desert test station is apparent to the Western group and to the Navy in 42 when I was with Conant. And I remember flying over that Southern California area with a party of naval officers and my Caltech group, and picking out the Inyokern area, which the Navy then proceeded to acquire and start Naval Ordnance Test Station at Inyokern. I had a landing field there, of course, and within a year's space of time, it was a thriving test station out in the desert. And the Caltech people used to have a team out there, a test team, supported by Navy personnel, Marines, aircraft. And out at Inyokern, they also built powder extrusion facilities to augment those of Eaton Canyon, which were experimental and had a very limited production. When the 5-inch aircraft rocket was tested and adapted, it was put on fighter aircraft with what they call zero-length launchers. Zero-length launchers are just little places to hang the rocket under the wing, because the speed of the aircraft, 300 miles an hour in those days, stabilized the rocket in its initial flight. It didn't need a launcher.
The plane itself was the launcher.
Yeah, the plane was the launcher. The invasion was going to take place in Normandy, and we manufactured 100 5-inch rockets per day, Caltech. They were loaded in aircraft and flown all the way to England, one plane leaving every day to an air base in southern England where they had P-47s. The Caltech team was at this air base and helped the Army install zero-length launchers and train the pilots to fire them. And using 100 rockets a day, those P-47s flew daily sorties against the German tanks in the weeks from D-Day on to the next several weeks. This was taking the entire output of the 5-inch rockets. The 5-inch rockets had a Navy 5-inch shell as its warhead. There were plenty of those available of all types. But took the entire output and flew it all the way to combat. In those days, when air transportation was so slow and so primitive compared to jet transportation today, 30 years later.
Where would they hop off from this side? Would they go through Canada?
Oh, they went up through Gander and, mm-hmm. and across to Ireland, I think. Maybe Iceland, I don't remember the route. That was all secret. All I know is that
they got
the Air Transport Command got them there. And then the pilots fired them against German tanks in Normandy. 10-inch aircraft rocket was a development for the Navy. We fired from a carriage underneath the airplane. 10-inch rocket was a big round. It was a tremendously big weapon.
Was the same technique that they used to launch torpedoes? Much the
Almost.
Same?
They had a simple little rig that suspended the rocket underneath the belly of the aircraft. And that would let down into the airstream and be fired from a position 3 or 4 feet below the belly of the airplane. It had a tremendous jet coming as it took off and had to be far enough below the airplane so the jet wouldn't strike the aircraft.
It would be
the
used
again. The first initial trials of the 10-inch aircraft rocket in war were to take place against the Japanese. And the first rockets were put on board the carrier Benjamin Franklin with a squadron equipped to train to fire them. I think that squadron had trained it. Initial training at Inyokern and then off the carriers. And remember, the Franklin was the victim of a kamikaze attack. The bombs went through into the carrier, the hangar deck, and the Franklin was severely damaged and set afire, and I don't know, thousands of the crew killed. And that holocaust, the 10-inch aircraft rockets, some of them were ignited and went off in the hangar aspect of the hangar part of the carrier. And this was, of course, in the last year of the war. And Franklin wasn't sunk. It was very badly damaged, and they finally got home. They had
under its own power.
Yeah, it had a tremendous casualty. It was one of the real carrier tragedies of the war. Following that, there wasn't time to equip another group to go out. That was in the spring of 45. So we never used the 10-inch aircraft rocket against targets. Well,
did the experience,
in the development of rocket weapons, bomb fuses and artillery fuses, neither was suitable for rocket fuses, had special problems. And under Charlie Lauritsen at Caltech, we had developed a large group of people that worked on the fuses for all our rockets. You needed impact fuses, you needed underwater fuses, you needed all kinds of fuses, time fuses, you know, for all these different rocket applications. And then, about a year before the war, progress on the war ended, progress on the atomic bomb had reached a stage where they needed help with their fusing problems of the atomic bomb. And arrangements were made for about half our fuse group to work on atomic bomb fuses. And Charlie Lauritsen and I used to go to Los Alamos to see Oppenheimer and his people on fusing problems.
How did Oppenheimer impress you?
Oh, Oppenheimer was a great man, no question about it. One set of interesting coincidences occurred in my life, my wartime life. A set of coincidences that was almost unbelievable. In the spring of 1941, when I was in London, Dr. Lauritsen came in the office in the embassy late one night. He was on a trip visiting the English laboratories. And late that night, about 11 o'clock, I was in the office in the embassy. He came in, pulled a paper out of his pocket and said, "This paper is so valuable, we must duplicate it at once and get it back to Van Bush." I said, "What is it, Charlie?" He said, "Well, you can read it yourself." I opened the paper, and it was marked British Top Secret. And I said, "Charlie, where'd you get it?" He said, "Oh, a friend of mine gave it to me." I said, "It's against all the regulations and agreements that we made with the British in the handling of our exchange of information." He said, "Yes, I know, but they want us to have it," meaning the scientists who gave this paper to Charlie. And it was the paper, it was a scientific paper which gave proof that the fission reaction produced neutrons with a coefficient greater than one. That is, for each fission that took place, more than one neutron would be released, and this meant that the chain reaction would go. And this was why the paper was so important. So we stayed up most of the night and duplicated the paper, and I got it off to Van Bush. Charlie returned the original document to the physicist who'd given it to him. Next summer, September of 1941, I had returned home, or September, we had the timing go. Spring of 1941, September of 1941, I'd come home. Towards the end of December, I was going back to London. Van Bush said he wanted me to carry a letter from the President of the United States to Prime Minister Churchill and deliver it 10 Downing Street. Of course I would. Van told me that what was in the letter, and it was the letter from the President to the Prime Minister agreeing on the part of this country with Britain to take responsibility for the development of the atomic bomb. The British had neither the manpower, they were fighting for their lives, everything was permitted, they couldn't do the job, impossible. So I delivered the letter at 10 Downing Street. Then, as I said, the contents of this letter, incidentally, are mentioned and I think reproduced in Churchill's history.
History of the war.
History of the war.
Your name in the footnote?
No, nobody knew who delivered the letter. I was just the courier in this case, but I happened to know it was in the letter. With my Caltech group working on the fuses for the rocket bomb.
Did you meet the PM, incidentally?
As I met the PM in the spring of 41, when I arranged for the PM to take an honorary degree from the University of Rochester in June of 41. See, his mother, Jenny Jerome, was a Rochester girl, and Churchill was given an honorary degree by the University of Rochester that June at the commencement exercise at U of R at the appointed time. President Valentine of Rochester introduced the Prime Minister, and he came on by radio. And I was in at 10 Downing Street in the room next to the Prime Minister, sitting with his secretary, listening to his speech, which was gone across the water and back again. And he made a magnificent speech. Of course, he was interested in having the U.S. in the war against Germany. That was his number one international policy at that time. And that's the story of that honorary degree is a story in itself. But at any rate, with half my fuse people working at Los Alamos, Larson and I used to go there occasionally, and we knew most of the people who were in that little mountain research center. Friends of mine from University of Minnesota were there, from the University of Rochester. But in August of 45, Watson and I were in Los Alamos and had an appointment to see Oppenheimer at 9 o'clock. We walked in his office. We were going to plan the work of the team for the next 6 months. And we'd just gotten started talking about what was to be done. The telephone rang. And Oppenheimer picked up the telephone and listened. And his first words, which we could hear, were, "And so they chose Hiroshima." That was Oppenheimer receiving the news that the atomic bomb had been dropped and was successful in Hiroshima. Well, needless to say, we never finished our conversation. The news was transferred to everybody at Los Alamos, and everything just stopped. It was a day of celebration.
You might expect it.
I happened to be there. Well, from the time we had the original paper which came through my hands, the agreement between the countries, and happening to be in Oppenheimer's office when he himself got word that the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, was a set of coincidences that the chances of occurring to any individual were
one in a billion,
extremely remote.
Yes. Should we have dropped it?
Yes, because of course, no question about it. See, the 10th Army was being put together in Hawaii for the invasion of Japan. And the 10th Army, if it had carried out an invasion of Japan, would have lost 1 million men. An atomic bomb meant the end of the war. The Japanese knew it, and we knew it. And essentially it saved 100,000 people, 200,000 people injured at Hiroshima, versus a million men. What's the choice? Say nothing of a million Japanese being killed, or more, by a full-scale invasion.
Did any of the people working with you at the moment bring up any of the problems that later been brought up about the morality of it, and had Japan defeated?
See, all the physicists at Los Alamos, from the time of the test at Alamogordo, which proved the bomb was successful, first one. The lab had started to disintegrate because all the people who worked on it knew exactly what they had done. They created the instrument that man could destroy himself with.
No margin for error now.
Well, they knew that they had participated in the development of a terrible, terrible weapon, and a weapon that would change the course of international relations and warfare from that time and all of history forward. And they knew also that the possession of this weapon was probably the greatest force for peace, too, as long as it could be held by one nation. And they knew that, they also knew that what they had done, the physicists of other nations could do, even though we put the greatest secrecy around it.
It would be
given time. The fact that we had done it, even though they didn't know how we had done it, physicists and other nations would have figured it out. Because the basic knowledge about the fission reaction was in the scientific literature in the 30s. In the nuclear physics, field of nuclear physics. And history subsequently proved that. The Russians had to start from scratch. They developed the atomic bomb very quickly.
Was it because?
The Chinese even, now the French.
And now the Jews in Israel.
And the Jewish Israel said they could do it. And they had plenty of nuclear physicists who knew what it required. Know what was required to make an atomic bomb.
Well, that certainly is a coincidence. Is I just can't believe it. Darn.
Well, after the atomic bomb in August of 45, the war came rapidly to an end, and that summer of 45, I'd been approached. Well, Alan Valentine wanted me to come back to the University of Rochester, and I'd intended to go back there. We liked Rochester, my wife and I. We liked the institution, liked the people, liked the city. People at Rice Institute came to see me, and I made a trip to Rice in the summer of 45. And then in July of 45, I was approached by Miss McHale. The woman trustee of Purdue was president of the Association, the American Association of University Women in Washington. I was interested in coming to Purdue. In July and August, those conversations went ahead.
You talked with her and with Allison Stewart, is that correct?
No, I talked with Miss McHale.
Mm-hmm.
And then later made a trip out here to see Allison Stewart, who was on the Board of Trustees at that time. Mr. Hanley in Indianapolis. chairman of the board in those days was Mr. Hillenbrand from Batesville. But Allison Stewart and Bill Hanley and Mr. Lynn in Indianapolis, Guy Wilson, Kokomo, we were all then on the board of trustees. And eventually they made me the offer. And if I remember correctly, in August. And Rice had never reached the stage where they actually invited me to come. But I would have taken Purdue even if Rice, if I had had the two offers to consider simultaneously. Because I wanted a land-grant institution, I wanted the Midwest. Well, I enjoyed Houston, and Rice was a very fine scientific institution. My interests, educationally speaking, at the university level, were more in the land-grant type of institution than in the private institution as represented by Rochester or Rice. I think my interest in the land-grant institution has been really developed from my Minnesota experience, both as a student and later as a member of the staff at Minnesota. War ended, and then I told the Purdue people I'd come in January. I had the problem of disposing of our rocket research organization, its programs, its research programs, turning them over to the military. Because when the war was over, the Army and Air Force, the Army and Navy, had finally learned what it meant, how important science was to warfare. And they weren't about to have any other kind of scheme to manage the defense of a nation other than under military jurisdiction. They weren't going to have another OSRD, civilian organization. So they set about immediately when the war ended to make sure that research and development of instrumentalities of war came under a military jurisdiction. The Research and Development Board was created under the Secretary of Defense soon after the war was over and reorganization took place. See, the Air Force was formed, it was Third Service. I'd been a member of the First Committee on Guided Missiles, the National Defense Research Committee. The first guided missiles were the so-called Azon and Razon bombs, controllable bombs. Azon controlled an azimuth only, and Razon both range and azimuth. Germans had worked on similar bombs for their Air Force, which had initial use in the Mediterranean. And it was a powerful weapon, you see, of aircrafts attacking surface ships. And if the Germans had been successful in developing really good controllable bombs, target-seeking bombs, or bombs that could be steered into targets, the Mediterranean would have become untenable for the Navy, unless you could give air cover above the fleet sufficient to keep all German aircraft away. But it had become obvious that guided missiles of all kinds were weapons of the future. Germans that had guided missiles in the sense of the V-2, the V-1. The V-1 was an aircraft guided missile. It was a simple little airplane carrying a bomb. Steered to its on its target, to on its course to its target by radio control. Also could be preset. V-2 had preset guidance in it. You can fly a given course and strike the city of London. V-2, of course, set by the Germans, was not an effective weapon because it carried a 3,000-pound warhead. A 3,000-pound bomb wasn't going to do much damage to London because you couldn't make the cost of sending that 3,000-pound bomb was far greater than the damage it could do. It was a very uneconomic weapon.
It was only a morale factor. Best.
It was a scare weapon.
But didn't they know that you couldn't scare the English?
Well,
you make them a little uneasy, but you don't scare them.
Well, no one scared the Germans either, and we bombed Germany even more severely than the Germans bombed the English.
Certainly we did.
I mean, we destroyed the cities like Munich and Hamburg
and Dresden. And the Germans I've met after the war know to the exact number of houses and dwellings and streets that the Schrecklich Bomben, as they always call them, use.
We had debated whether or not to commit the manpower to develop a long-range rocket of the kind like the V-2. You see, the V-2 experimental station at Peenemünde, under von Braun, developed the V-2. And they fired their experimental V-2s up the Baltic. Their range was from Peenemünde up the Baltic. When I was in London in spring of 41, I think it was, when word came to us that a V-2 had gotten away off course, landed in Sweden, and the farm exploded. The Swedish army moved in and cordoned off the farm and collected all the pieces. We, the British and ourselves, organized a team of scientists and sent them into Sweden. They looked at these pieces that were left and reconstructed the V-2.
Be darned.
Almost perfectly.
I never heard that story.
So we knew about the V-2 and its characteristics from this report. And in the, we'd given a lot of hard-edged analysis at the time. And we finally came to the conclusion that it would be a real waste of scientific effort and manpower, with the atomic bomb receiving highest priority at that time, the beginnings of it. We had no experience with the rocket engines of this particular kind. And the weapon didn't mean anything unless you could put an atomic bomb in the nose. It meant something to put an atomic bomb, because one atomic bomb would destroy the whole of London. And one V-2, you couldn't stop it. So it was a surefire weapon if you had an atomic bomb. So we started the V-2 immediately after the war. The Army started the initial program, knowing that this was under the guided missiles program of the Research and Development Board, and I was on the Research and Development Board. And Chairman of the Guided Missiles Committee at the Research and Development Board. And one of the continuing research and development programs then of the Air Force and the Army both was the development of long-range rockets and of guidance systems and a whole series of weapons, guided missile weapons. At that time, after the war, you had different kinds of rocket jet-propelled engines to consider. You had different kinds of fuels, ranging from solid cast fuels to liquid fuels of the kind they use now in the Saturn rockets, the Apollo rockets. You had many different kinds of guidance systems proposed for all of those types. One of the considerations right after the war that was dominant in the management of the R&D program was that many of the research and development teams were associated with the aircraft industry on the West Coast. While procurement and production of military airplanes then ceased in the numbers that were required for World War II, it was important that all these teams be kept in being, and be given work to do, because they were tremendously important to the status of our national defense. And so we instituted under the Research and Development Board, the Guided Missiles Committee, literally hundreds and hundreds of projects, many of which at that time were competing. They were competitive projects because we didn't know which competitor would turn out to be the better. We had no way of judging. And each scheme and each particular methodology had merit of some kind, had points of merit and points of demerit, advantages and disadvantages. And a great many people were working on rocket engines, for instance. And we knew that the moment the atomic energy, the atomic bomb people told us that they could make a 3,000-pound atomic bomb, that we then could make an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM. I was on a special committee which was empowered to do what was necessary to marry the atomic bomb and the missile, set parameters and so on for both groups who worked independently of each other.
Now, was this under all under the Department of Defense?
This was under the Department of Defense and the Research and Development Board after the war. 4 or 5 years of the war. And when the atomic bomb people told us they could make a 3,000-pound warhead, then this committee made the necessary decisions as to sizes and diameters and weights and other requirements that both groups had to know to marry the warhead with a
Was it a metallurgical problem too in this?
There are all kinds of metallurgical problems. There are all kinds of problems. Every problem in the book with a complicated weapon system. Development problems. Design problems. People problems. Production problems. Training problems. Storage problems. Deployment problems.
You name it, you had it.
You name it, you had everything, you see. In the years following the war, of course, I'd come to Purdue and was president of an institution that was struggling then with the wartime post-war problems. They were fascinating days, those years of 47, 46, 47, 48. We had two generations in the university simultaneously, the generation called GIs who fought the war anywhere from 1 to 5 years, and the youngsters who'd just gotten out of college, the normal college generation. You had to do things in a makeshift way to take care of 15,000 students in 47, 48. We turned the armory into a fabrication plant and built 150 black and white houses, which you remember.
I do.
Went down State Street. We built the student barracks, from old army barracks. And we put the buildings over on Stewart Field here.
I remember teaching in class in Quonset Hut.
You couldn't get materials after the war. And it was a long time before the building industry caught up with the 5 years that nothing had been done.
Right.
GIs made life miserable and interesting for the teaching staff of the university, as you know. They wanted to get through, they were serious, they were mature, they'd been to the wars. Many of them were married and introduced the married student problem to the campus.
To say nothing of just the problem of a small, in a sense, mechanical and agricultural college, high quality, suddenly meeting the demands of a huge operation. That alone was one of the problems I remember, because the psychology of those who had stayed here, they were used to a small, doing things in a small college, and this is tough. And yet you seemed to, there was sort of a spirit of cooperation and a willingness to take a chance that prevailed back then.
Well, the people here always had the capacity and the know-how to get things done.
Yes, we did. You're right.
Yeah, there was a high degree of unity and cooperation and pride and helpfulness and all the rest of it. And, everywhere you turned, there was facilities to be needed and to be built. There were opportunities.
Is there any major problem that you had to whip before you could get it solved, or were there so many going on simultaneously?
Well, that was the real problem. I mean, you faced a simultaneous broad-scale development across the whole board, plus if you were to be a major university, you had to have a top-flight graduate school, and you had to have a you had to have the things that went with science and technology that made for an educated man, namely the humanities and the social sciences. And then what lay ahead was fairly obvious because of the population boom following the war. You could see the basic number. Basic planning number for higher education was the number of kids born 18 years before. And you knew exactly, or knew within very narrow limits, what the load would be 20 years later, 18 years later. You take 100 babies born in 1946, and you know how many are going to enter first grade, and you know how many are going to graduate from high school. Of those that graduate from high school, you knew that there was going to be a progressive increase in the number that went on to college. And so you could make estimates 18 years beforehand of the problem you faced. And this is exactly what Herman Wells and I did with the colleges in Indiana. We told them in the years right after the war, all the private colleges, that they'd have to get in and pitch and plan to double their enrollments. Otherwise, the kids would all come to the state universities. We knew also that we'd have to develop our regional campus system.
then in a sense, once a, everything is just to make these things come true,
exactly,
and to hold them in check. That's really been the problem, hasn't
exactly
it?
Exactly. And then you knew that knowledge itself would advance on a broad front, as it had during the war, and in terms of research. You knew there'd be a tremendous development of the graduate school, of all its aspects. You knew, as Van Bush said, science was the endless frontier and the only frontier open to you. And there were no more frontiers except space, and no more frontiers on Mother Earth.
That's right.
And so you had a general problem with so many things to be done for each year and each biennial period. You picked out as many of those things that you could get a start on. But when you wanted to do something, you wanted to do something and put it in being and put it in operation as quickly as possible. You didn't want to dissipate your energies over the whole spectrum. You picked out parts of the spectrum and did it as well as you could with what you had.
Was there a then?
Excuse me. And then over a period of time, you would begin to build the whole. The whole would come along. Take the life science building. When I came to Purdue, I told the biologists here that the first 50 years of the 20th century would belong to the chemist and physicist. The second 50 years would belong to the biological scientists. And the life science building, in concept, is the largest classroom, laboratory, building in the world, I think. And it took us 8 years. It took us 8 years to build that complex.
Well, if you consider what you had, you did it pretty fast.
Well, you did it about as fast as it can be done.
Well, I take it from talking to Professor Mellon, the ideas of the new chemistry building just being completed started about then, didn't they?
Well, the chemistry building, you see, has had, this is the second edition in my time.
Yeah.
Wetherill Labs were built in place of the old chemical lab there. Then we had built the Ag Biochemistry building, too. Well, we'll start up.
All right, we'll end this interview. This is the end of the fourth interview for the Purdue University Archives. President Emeritus Frederick L. Hovde and Mr. Eckert.